The PA is widely unpopular among Palestinians, many of whom see it as an extension of the Israeli occupation. The PA has not held elections in 18 years. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 57 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 51 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Greetings. Bienvenidos a todo mi gente escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, at Distrito Colombia, here on this Friday, March 29, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez. And today on the show, we put the spotlight once again on Honduras following the guilty verdict on former coup president Juan Orlando Hernandez on drug trafficking charges. Earlier this month, former Honduran coup president Juan Orlando Hernandez was convicted in a New York federal court on drug trafficking charges and taking bribes from traffickers in exchange for protection. During his time as president from 2014 to 2022, despite numerous reports of human rights violations and accusations of corruption and involvement with drug smuggling, he remained a close U.S. ally in the region during his tenure. With this ruling, it could be argued that the court of law in the U.S. has finally caught up with what activists and the Honduran court of public opinion have concluded with regards to Hernandez for several years. And so our guests today will not only give us their opinions on the significance of this ruling, but also how the damage done by U.S. support of successive coup governments remains a challenge for Honduras today and tomorrow. And so with us on the show today is Adrienne Pine. She's an anthropologist and co-coordinator of the International Coalition to Stop Genocide in Palestine. Welcome back to the show, Adrienne Pine.
Thanks so much for having me back, Oscar.
Absolutely. And joining us on the show for the first time is Karen Spring. She's a researcher, the host of the Honduras Now podcast, and a co-coordinator of the Honduras Solidarity Network. Welcome to the show, Karen Spring.
Hi, thank you so much, Oscar. It's a pleasure to be here with you and Adrian.
Absolutely. It's great to have the both of you on for this show today. Perhaps the best way to sum up Honduras under Juan Orlando Hernandez is to quote Assistant U.S. Attorney Jacob Gutwilling, who told the court that Hernandez, quote, paved a cocaine superhighway to the United States. So there's a lot of details here that we need to dive deep into. But before we do that, what are your initial thoughts? And let me start with Karen. What are your initial thoughts on the guilty verdict here? And I just want to say, sort of as a side note here, that Juan Orlando Hernandez, you know, back in 2013, when he was running for president, sort of as a hardliner against crime, he touted his role in the passage of a constitutional amendment that paved the way for the extradition of Honduran traffickers for the first time. And based on this case, it ultimately ended up being used against him here.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, the fact that he approved that law, Juan Orlando Hernandez used that as an excuse to show and to say over several years that he was working really, really closely with the United States because he passed really favorable laws like the extradition law that was ultimately used against him basically as soon as he left office, his second term in office in 2022. And so actually throughout the trial, his trial in New York, Juan Orlando Hernandez said, and his defense attorney said, how could he possibly be a drug trafficker if he's the one that's responsible for passing an extradition law that led to the extradition of some of the witnesses and a lot of the drug traffickers that are in prison in the United States now? So that connection's really important. And just my initial reflections on the guilty verdict. So the guilty verdict came down on March 8th in the Southern District Court of New York. And what it means is that Juan Orlando Hernandez was found guilty by a New York jury on three counts of conspiring to traffic cocaine, like thousands of kilos of cocaine into the United States, and also weapons-related charges, which meant he used destructive devices and machine guns to traffic cocaine into the United States. And so he now faces a 40-year mandatory sentence, which will probably end up being life in prison plus 30 years. And so in terms of what this means, just initially, it means that for once, there's a tiny little bit of justice for Hondurans that were so deeply affected by Ho's two terms, and Ho being J-O-H, Juan Orlando Hernandez, his acronym, or the acronym of his name. It's a tiny, tiny bit of justice, but there's still so much left to do in Honduras in terms of the justice that has still not been achieved.
Adrian Pine, also want to get your initial thoughts on what took place in New York this month.
Well, I couldn't agree more with Karen on the fact that while this is a little tiny bit of justice, what we really need to be focused on is the fact that the U.S. propped this narco dictator up for all of these years, that his turning the country into a narco dictatorship, which it still is structurally, because he managed to completely gut the institutions and reform them into, you know, the military, for example, the police are basically cartels in Honduras. And he managed to do that. So even with a president now who was for the first time since the 2009 coup popularly elected and who, you know, has stated her intentions, and the Libre Party of the resistance movement has stated their intentions and certainly have been trying to change the structure of Honduras, that is an enormous task. And that is because of U.S. and Canadian support for Juan Orlando, knowing full well the whole time exactly what he was doing. They waited until the power changed hands to extradite him. But we know all along, I mean, for example, the documents came out when his brother was tried, Tony Hernandez, in August 2019, naming Juan Orlando as a co-conspirator. And still, after that, for years, he was celebrated by the successive U.S. administrations as being the greatest partner in the fight against drug trafficking in Central America. So that's really where our focus needs to continue to be, even as we celebrate that he is being held accountable for his part in ruining so many lives.
Yeah, unfortunately, this small degree of justice that we're talking here is going to be a running theme here, because the damage that's been done afterwards isn't and will not go away just because Juan Orlando Hernandez has now been convicted in a court of law here in the U.S. So while the former Honduran president may be the headliner in this trial, by no means was he alone in the development of this drug trafficking structure that still exists today in Honduras. So as Adrian just mentioned, in 2018, Hernandez's brother, Tony Hernandez, was arrested in Miami for trafficking 185 tons of cocaine as well as firearms. 3 years later, in 2021, a U.S. court sentenced him to life in prison, as Adrian just mentioned. In addition, former National Police Chief Juan Carlos Bonilla entered a guilty plea to one count of cocaine importation conspiracy earlier this year. Even the son of former coup president Porfirio Lobo was implicated during the course of the trial. So are there other bad actors in this criminal enterprise that are also worth mentioning here? One of the main things that many activists have pointed out over the years has been not only U.S. companies with regards to mining, but also Canadian companies along the way as well.
Well, I really want to let Karen talk about Canadian companies because she's more of an expert than I am on that particular topic. But as to the question, are there other bad actors? Of course, there are so many bad actors. But more than that, I think that the system was restructured to be rotten to the core. It's impossible to be a good actor in a military that operates as a drug cartel, in a police force that operates as a drug cartel. Right now, I'm working on an asylum case supporting a police officer who tried to do the right thing and report when he found his colleagues drug trafficking, engaging in targeted assassinations of people who were trying to report them for drug trafficking and engaging in all sorts of corruption and bribery. And of course, he ended up having to flee the country because of the death threats he got. So you get an honest person inside these institutions and they get killed. So, you know, there are institutions that don't allow people to be good actors. I mean, I don't think this is structurally that different from police in the United States or people in the U.S. military, for example. But I think the focus really needs to be on institutions at the same time as we're talking about bad actors. Now, a lot of the people who were engaged in the same kinds of crimes as the former president and Tigre Bonilla and all of those folks who have recently been tried in New York fled the country to places where they can't be extradited, like Nicaragua, for example, which doesn't have an extradition treaty. So you've got all sorts of people who are actively escaping the law and or people who continue to be on the lam despite the fact that lots of folks know where they are. Major criminals like a fellow named El Porquis, the head of the MS-13, who escaped in a very dramatic escape that was facilitated by Juan Orlando Hernandez, and continues to run MS-13 gang in Honduras. And you've got other examples like the drug trafficker Chepito Handel, who's supposedly carrying out a sentence in prison, but actually, you know, it seems to not be doing that at all, seems to be living freely. So the system is entirely beneficial to these people who we might call bad actors. But I would say the worst actor of all in Honduras is the U.S. Embassy. I mean, we have to look at what the U.S. Embassy is doing to foment counterinsurgency. I mean, the counterinsurgency plan, you know, the government has accused the U.S. Embassy repeatedly of trying to carry out another coup. And there's plenty of evidence that the embassy is doing everything it can to prevent this government from having any sort of success in turning the country around from the disaster that the U.S. Juan Orlando Hernandez and Canada alliance created over the course of his narco dictatorship.
Oh, yeah. And to support what you just said there, I had the pleasure last week of having freelance writer Michael Fox on the show here. He did the amazing podcast docuseries Under the Shadow. And last week on the show, we were talking about the forgotten struggles for social justice in Honduras during the 1980s. And he mentioned quite clearly that the same infrastructure that the U.S. used during that time period for the Contra War against the Sandinistas is still in place today. The same military base that was used against the Sandinistas was also the same base where they took Manuel Zelaya in 2009 during the coup of that year. So I want to bring our attention to now to the mining companies with regards to Canada, American mining companies with regards to the coup government in Honduras during this time period has been well documented. With regards to Canada, I think it should be more documented than it has already. There's this fantastic book by a Canadian writer by the name of Tyler Shipley, who wrote an entire book on Canadian involvement with regards to the coup. So Karen, please fill us in.
Thank you so much, Oscar. And I think it's really important what Adrian was mentioning and your question related to other bad actors. And I think that to understand the U.S. and Canadian support over so many years during basically since the 2009 coup in Honduras, and then the two presidents that were in power since then, Juan Orlando Hernández being the longest, who he was in power for two terms, for 8 years. I think to understand the significant U.S. and Canadian support for the narco state, the rise of the narco dictatorship in Honduras, was because both post-coup governments were so favorable to U.S. and Canadian economic interests. And so economic and political interests, I should say. I think that one of the things that Canada gained from the narco state in Honduras was that a new favorable mining law was passed. Immediately after the coup, Canada signed a free trade agreement. It was one of the first countries to really establish significant trading relationships with Honduras after the coup. And the Prime Minister of Canada traveled to Honduras and actually met with Porfirio Lobo Sosa, who was implicated in Juan Orlando Hernández's trial, whose actual son testified against Juan Orlando Hernández in the trial in New York and said, my dad was involved in drug trafficking and I was trafficking drugs with the Honduran police and military under my father's direction. So I think that Canadian mining companies and American mining companies, they gained concessions. They were able to begin operations in the narco state in Honduras. And they basically knew that they were doing business with a very problematic regime in Honduras that was allowing them to operate, creating the political and economic conditions for them to operate, but also repressing and using the state security forces, the police and the military that were also trafficking drugs, were repressing and basically criminalizing opposition to these mining companies. So for example, Juan Orlando Hernández had a very close business ally. His name was Lenir Perez, and Lenir Perez had a mining operation that was working alongside one of the U.S.'s largest steel companies called Nucor Corporation. And Juan Orlando Hernández's government threw water defenders in prison who were resisting that mining operation. And so Nucor Corporation, you know, was one of the businesses under the narco state that really benefited from Honduras being converted into a dictatorship, a narco state, basically. And then on the Canadian side, you know, there was a mining company on the border with Guatemala in one of the biggest drug trafficking regions in Honduras called Aura Minerals. It's actually owned by a U.S. company now, but back then it was Canadian. And they, you know, were destroying the community cemeteries. They were throwing local community members that were resisting the mining operation in prison, you know, all while they were working alongside, these companies were working alongside a narco state. I think that's one of the things, these bad actors that unfortunately were never mentioned in the trial of Juan Orlando Hernández in New York, but that were very much part of the construction of not only Juan Orlando Hernández's power as a violent drug trafficker who is also in the presidency, but also the creation of a narco state that had very, very significant impacts on Honduras, continue to have really detrimental impacts on Honduras, and that basically caused Honduras to turn into a very violent country, especially for those that were speaking out against the government at the time.
See, this is why we need to know all the bad actors, because I was not aware that a mining company had desecrated a cemetery. That should have been a lot more front page with regards to Latin American news in the last few years, in my opinion. And I just have to say that before I go to the next question, another bad actor that I would like to highlight during the course of this coup government over the years has been Juan Orlando Hernández's own party, the National Party, because he cannot be everywhere and anywhere all at once. There was this institution of people, an entire political party, that went along and participated in what is now a narco state and what has been proven in a court of law as well as a result. So I bring that up because apart from the charges of drug trafficking, I want to know if either one of you can tell us about some other transgressions that Hernandez committed in his time in office. That includes possibly stealing an election, which, again, it shows that Juan Orlando Hernandez, the individual, could not have done all of these things by himself.
Your point about the National Party is really important because the National Party, Honduras has long been basically had two parties, like throughout its history, the Liberal Party and the National Party. And the National Party has always been a very significant ally of the United States government, largely because they promote U.S. interests, U.S. economic interests and political interests that, you know, they're basically like aligned because they have very similar interests. But I think that Ho's crimes, you know, I wanted to mention something really quickly, that after the trial, in the last 2 days of the trial, Hondurans from all over the United States that have either migrated to the United States, were forced to flee Honduras under the dictatorship, they basically organized a vigil outside the New York Southern District Court on the last couple of days of Juan Orlando Hernandez's trial and as the jury was deliberating. And at that vigil, there were candles, there were flags, Honduran flags, but there were also pictures of all of these individuals, campesinos, environmentalists, land defenders, Afro-Indigenous, Garifuna people, Berta Cáceres, people that had been murdered under the Juan Orlando Hernandez dictatorship and by the post-coup regimes. And so I think that that vigil for me represented kind of two things, to show one, that the crimes, Juan Orlando Hernandez's drug trafficking was the least of his crimes, really, that he committed. And two, the ongoing thirst and need for justice in Honduras. And so I think that Juan Orlando Hernandez is being pinned as a violent drug trafficker, but he was also involved in so many corruption schemes in Honduras that basically stole public money from the Social Security Institute, for example,
yes,
that basically left the public health system, the public hospital medical system totally bankrupt. And who knows, thousands of people died at the height of that scandal. The impacts of it are continued today in the healthcare system. Juan Orlando Hernandez was involved in stealing two elections, and the 2017 electoral crisis was one of the worst. And, you know, people were thrown in prison, including my partner, Edwin Espinel. He was a political prisoner thrown in a maximum security prison for 19 months and held there without trial. And there were over 30 people that were killed in the 2017 electoral crisis, too. And part of Juan Orlando Hernandez's crimes was not only drug trafficking and using the police, the U.S. trained, funded Honduran military and police to basically repress his opponents, but he also controlled all aspects of the state and he took over the state. And part of doing that was not only receiving drug bribes and working alongside drug traffickers, but it was also stealing a lot of public money that still has a huge impact in Honduras today.
And just to add to what Karen is saying, really, if we look back at the coup, the main project of the coup was just completely overwhelmingly violent neoliberal restructuring of the country, a militarized neoliberal restructuring of the country, which results in what I call neoliberal fascism. So you see, even before Juan Orlando was elected president, what do? They attack the unions tremendously violently. In 2010, you see these incredible violent attacks on the teachers' union so that they can privatize education, so that businessmen in Honduras, mostly men, I say that because it is gendered, can profit from the privatization of education. The same thing with hospitals. You see them intentionally gutting the hospital system so that their friends who are owners of private hospitals can thrive tremendously. You see this rampant sell-off of Honduran lands. The conference that they had again in 2010 called Honduras is Open for Business, which sort of marks the celebration of this project of here, have some mining contracts here, take the indigenous land or waterways. And that was all geared toward taking away any ounce of sovereignty that people might have, any hope for democracy, and entirely turning Honduras into a foreign-owned corporate project that benefited United States corporate interests, Canadian corporate interests, and corporate interests from abroad. And this necessitated violence. It went hand in hand with turning Honduras into a narco state. Juan Orlando Hernandez, of course, also, as part of his campaign, instituted the military police. And this was after, you know, in the 1980s, there had been the militarization of the whole country and there had been famous death squads and there was a real pushback against this in the 90s. And they managed to demilitarize, you know, they separate the military and police forces. But that came back together again with Juan Orlando Hernandez. So it really is a much bigger project than just drug trafficking. And we need to keep that in mind. Another thing that I think is really important to keep in mind in terms of talking about this as a project of neoliberal fascism is that Juan Orlando's, and talking about bad actors like we were before, is that Juan Orlando's closest allies, apart from the United States, were Israel. He was celebrated by the Israelis as having been the first graduate of Mashav, which is their, you know, one of their leadership programs in Israel, where they send people from around the world to get training to become the president, a head of state. And he did everything he could to bolster Israeli financial interests and power in Honduras. And it's important to mention that most of the guns that the police have are Israeli model. I mean, there was an intense amount of business that was created through these neoliberal fascist connections that included Israel, that are connected to the Zionist project worldwide. And we see that here. And that actually came out in his trial. There was an article that came out in The Intercept about this, the fact that when one of the people who was testifying against Juan Orlando Hernandez was asked how they did the drug running, that he actually mentioned that it was through an Israeli diplomat who actually carried their drug money in whatever suitcases, you know, and in conjunction with, you know, with Juan Orlando Hernandez's drug trafficking. So these ties are deep. The bad actors are international, and they're very much acting in coordination, and they continue to be dangerous for Honduras and, frankly, all of us.
We're going to take a break right here, but before we do, I just want to say, in the interest of full disclosure, for several years, I worked as an interpreter for asylum cases who were seeking out physical exams as part of their asylum case. And being here in Washington between 2009, you know, when the coup took place, up until today, you could see with your own eyes in the Washington area how the Honduran community has grown exponentially during this time. And it's not going to go away anytime soon. So when Adrian says that this was a neoliberal fascist state, we could see it with our own eyes, the consequences of such a state here in the Washington area alone. So I just want to throw that out there as food for thought. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Adrian Pine, who's an anthropologist and co-coordinator of the International Coalition to Stop Genocide in Palestine. And we're also speaking with Karen Spring, who's a researcher, host of the Honduras Now podcast, and a co-coordinator of the Honduras Solidarity Network. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Se va a enojar tu patrón si no llegas tempranito a sembrarle con primor. Y como no tenés tierra, siembras en la tierra del patrón. Y como no tenés tierra, siembras en la tierra del patrón. Apúrate, compañero, que tenés que ir a ordeñar. Tenés que aguar el ganado, chapear, postear y sembrar. Como sos analfabeta, te quedaste para peor. Y como no tenés vacas, hombre, la leche es de tu patrón. Y como no tenés vacas, hombre, la leche es de tu patrón. Domingo en el estadio, gritando a todo pulmón, tomándote una cerveza y vuelta a gritar. No es que sea malo el deporte, ni malo que sea jugar, pero es
ese equipo no es tuyo, hombre, también es de tu patrón. Pero ese equipo no es tuyo, hombre, también es de tu patrón. Decir quisieras hoy lo mala que está tu vida, que te oigan de viva voz. Se me atraganta la vida tener que decirlo yo. Ese congreso no es tuyo, hombre, también es de tu patrón. Ese congreso no es tuyo, hombre, también es de tu patrón.
That was Mario de Mezapa, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about Juan Orlando Hernandez, the former coup president of Honduras, following his guilty verdict. With Adrian Pine, who's an anthropologist and co-coordinator of the International Coalition to Stop Genocide in Palestine, and Karen Spring, who's a researcher, host of the Honduras Now podcast, and a co-coordinator of the Honduras Solidarity Network. So for people that are familiar with Central American history, there were immediate comparisons with the conviction of Hernandez with former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega in the 80s, and how they were both U.S. allies in the quote-unquote war on drugs. But I would also argue that as a more recent example, we can draw parallels between Hernandez and former Mexican drug czar Genaro García Luna, who was also convicted last year in a U.S. court of drug trafficking and organized crime. The parallels may vary, but one common denominator is U.S. support. So how important, perhaps, is this sort of omission of U.S. accountability in telling the whole story in Honduras, not just Juan Orlando Hernandez, the individual, but the whole story of U.S. support in Honduras here?
Yeah, so I just wanted to actually mention something. I'm really glad that you're drawing out the U.S. role and not just the U.S. role in Honduras, you know, under Juan Orlando Hernandez, but the history of U.S. intervention and the role of the United States in the region over decades. And I think this is one of the reasons that the Honduras Solidarity Network is actually, we've launched a campaign in light of this trial against Juan Orlando Hernandez in New York to basically make these connections, have these discussions about the role of the United States and Canada in backing a narco dictatorship in Honduras, but also to draw on all these discussions that have been happening in Latin America over decades. Like I said, the role of the U.S. is just so clear over so many years, decades. And so we've launched this campaign. It's called Putting the U.S. and Canada on Trial Campaign. And it is to hold the U.S. and Canada accountable for the role they played in the construction of the narco state in Honduras in light of Ho's trial in New York. And so we have two main demands, and we have five demands in total. And I'm just going to mention them quickly. One of them is we are asking, now that we know, now that Juan Orlando Hernandez has been convicted, he will spend the rest of his life in prison. He's been found guilty of drug trafficking. He's a violent drug trafficker. We are saying that the United States and Canada need to be held responsible for helping him, basically assisting him construct a narco state in Honduras and funding and training the Honduran military and police that were also trafficking drugs alongside him. Which this, again, is not something that's unique to Honduras. This is something that's been going on for a very long time in Latin America in terms of the U.S. role. So we are asking for investigations and inquiries in Congress and in Parliament in Canada to look at the role of the United States and Canada in the construction of the narco state, as well as declassifying documents that link to that role. And so we think that, you know, the elephant in the courtroom, as was, you know, these trials in, you know, with Garcia Luna in Mexico, or going all the way back to, if you wanted to, going back to Noriega in Panama. You could say that the elephant in the room is constantly being missed. And that elephant in the courtroom is the role of the United States in backing these governments. And then they themselves put these violent drug traffickers, or however they want to frame them, on trial in the United States, almost saying, look, we're the heroes. We are cracking down on these violent drug traffickers. Therefore, our job is done here. When there's really no discussion of, wait a second, what was the role of the United States and Canada in this? And most people know that if they know the history of Latin America.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up as well, because in the coming weeks and months ahead, I do intend on dedicating an entire show with regards to Canadian mining companies and how Canada has a role in one form or another with regards to Honduras as it pertains to some of the things that you've mentioned already. Because one thing that I've always said with regards to Chile, but I think it applies to Honduras here, is that sometimes the scandal isn't that the government or that private companies broke the law, but rather that they didn't have to, meaning that the corruption and the inherent injustice in some laws that were implemented during the time period of Juan Orlando Hernández is not the bug, but rather the feature. Even as we have this conversation today, there were contracts that were written and signed with foreign companies where we don't really know how they could be broken or how they were agreed upon in the first place or where the documents even are to begin with. So, yeah, I mean, what you're proposing is certainly at the very least a Pandora's box that will shine a spotlight on Canada.
Yeah, and I actually just wanted to mention something really quickly, Oscar. And in the case of Honduras, and this is something that our campaign is going to talk about as we move forward, there is evidence that there are U.S. and Canadian companies that actually were involved with drug traffickers, had business relationships with drug traffickers. So one of the things that came out in a trial, not in Ho's trial recently, but in another drug trafficking trial related to Honduran drug traffickers, there was a U.S. petroleum company that basically gave money to Juan Orlando Hernández's presidential campaign in exchange for the concession to explore petroleum off of the coast of Honduras. And that is like a bribe, you know, a U.S. petroleum company paying a bribe to a drug trafficker so that he'll favor them in receiving contracts. Also, there's a Canadian company called Gildan Activewear, which if you're a student listening to this and you're in the United States, a lot of your universities will purchase Gildan products for their own university wear. Gildan Activewear actually is a very large textile and clothing company that has factories in Honduras. And they actually had a business relationship and lent money to one of Juan Orlando Hernández's drug associates, who's now, his name is Giovanni Fuentes Ramirez, who they called their partner, their business partner. And they actually had a biomass contract with Giovanni Fuentes Ramirez, who's now facing life in prison for drug trafficking in the United States. And basically, Giovanni Fuentes used that relationship with Gildan Activewear to launder his drug money and also to cut down trees to create biomass that Gildan was then saying, using to say that they were a green company and that they abided by corporate social responsibility. And, you know, there are so many cases of U.S. and Canadian companies that actually had direct contracts and with drug traffickers in Honduras and bribed Juan Orlando Hernández and helped keep him in power because he was providing such a beneficial business, basically, environment for them. So I think those are really important to mention, that the U.S. and Canada are so much part of the problem. And that's why we need investigations in the U.S. and Canada about just how much we were involved in that narco state.
Yeah, I've heard aspects of this along the Atlantic coast, and I would give credit to OFRANE, which is the Afro-Honduran organization that has fought the good fight in trying to maintain their lands from, as you said, these type of developers who are trying to make money off the resources of the Honduran public. So in addition to U.S. culpability that should have been addressed in this trial, the case of Juan Orlando Hernández also breaks the, you know, quote-unquote Republican versus Democrat paradigm that often limits the frame of debating when it comes to U.S. foreign policy in Latin America. Because both parties view the Honduran coup government as an ally in the quote-unquote war on drugs during this time period. So rather than measure which party is more responsible than the other, does this form of bipartisan support for a coup government, any coup government, make it easier for U.S. hypocrisy to sort of go under the radar here? Because over the years, it's really made me pull my hair why this hasn't gotten more attention than it has and why it hasn't gotten the attention that it deserves, considering everything that we mentioned thus far during the course of this conversation.
You know, Oscar, Honduras had a bipartisan or a two-party system that was modeled after the United States system, and the U.S. really played a big role in enforcing that about 100 years ago. That system fell apart with the coup because both of the major parties supported the coup. The Liberal Party, which is now a shadow of its former self and is also a drug trafficking operation, just like the National Party and the National Party. So that fell apart because it turned out that they were really two sides of the same coin. Of course, those of us who know anything about how the U.S. government works knows that it's the same thing. We have two corporate imperialist capitalist parties. The differences between them, I think, are more in rhetoric than anything else. But if you look at their policies vis-a-vis Honduras or anywhere else in the world, they're doing basically the same thing. The coup happened under Obama. Obama at first, the very first few days, said some words about it being a coup and that being bad. But Hillary Clinton very quickly put him in line as Secretary of State. And nobody supported the coup more than Obama. But then, you know, through the subsequent Republican and Democrat administrations, you see the exact same support. So as you're mentioning, and I think this is key also, because when you look at the rhetoric that Democrats say about themselves, you know, they're talking about being good on immigrant rights. But of course, Obama deported more people than anybody. Biden, using the crisis in 2014 of the supposed unaccompanied minor crisis, right, which really was a crisis of people fleeing the dictatorship in Honduras, not a crisis of bad parenting, as they painted it in the media, or, you know, parents who are, you know, not responsible for their kids. That was an excuse for Joe Biden to go in and push through a plan that just intensified neoliberal fascism by opening up more contracts and more investment opportunities for companies from the United States and investing more in police and military training, supposed security. So you have this total increase in fascist policies that are harming the lives of migrants who are fleeing from U.S. foreign policy to start out with, that is actually worse during Democratic administrations. But they're just not saying the horrible things that Trump says. So everybody thinks that, oh, the Democrats are better because they're, you know, not building a wall and calling immigrants, you know, rapists and whatever. But the policies are the same, and we need to recognize that. And it's long past time that we recognize that. And that's clear right now, for example, with what's happening in Gaza. I mean, we've got the president is supporting a genocide, and both candidates are, you know, enthusiastically supporting a genocide. We have to recognize that we can no longer support the lesser evil in this country because the lesser evil is genocide.
Unbelievable. And the 2020 census sort of proved your point as far as how exponentially the Honduran community grew in the United States, if not nationwide, certainly here in the Washington area. And just once again, another sample or proof, rather, of how this state terrorized its own people. It's almost like Honduras went back to the future, going back to the 80s, and going through the same experience that El Salvador and Guatemala did during that time period. Even though it's been 15 years, I still look at it as surreal when it comes to Central American history, how what took place in the 80s happened in Honduras in recent times. So I don't think we could have this conversation without mentioning Berta Cáceres, who was the indigenous activist in Honduras who was murdered several years ago, because as recently as last December, authorities in Honduras issued an arrest warrant for the alleged mastermind of her murder. At first glance, this may not have much to do with the case of Juan Orlando Hernandez, but Berta Cáceres' organization, COPIN, certainly thought that way. They posted a tweet when he was arrested, quote, "The corporation banking mafia of Honduras, made up of Atala, who was the alleged mastermind here, and others have been the main beneficiaries and backers of Juan Orlando Hernandez." This was the tweet from COPIN, particularly from Berta Cáceres' daughter And so, in your opinion, where do you fit this with what took place recently with the trial of Juan Orlando Hernández?
You're right. I think that it's really important to mention Berta Cáceres. One, because of how special of an indigenous leader and activist she was in Honduras, and how she was murdered for speaking out against this economic model that Adrian has talked a lot about. And because also Berta Cáceres represents the hundreds of people, thousands, if you could even say, that were killed under a narco state. And the thing about Berta Cáceres' case is hers is a really good example of what basically happened in Honduras throughout, basically since the coup. And, you know, the Civic Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras, COPIN, which is the organization she co-founded, as you're saying, Oscar, and Berta's family continues to fight a really difficult situation in Honduras because of the narco state and how it's being still basically maintained in a lot of the state institutions. So there have been 7 material authors. And when we say material, the individuals that basically went into her home and killed her for being so outspoken against a hydroelectric dam that was internationally funded by international financial institutions. But also she was murdered because of how outspoken she was against the narco state and Juan Orlando Hernández. But I think, too, her murder represents something that came out very clearly in the trial, and that is the role of the police, the military in both drug trafficking, but also in committing human rights violations, and also the role of the United States in training Honduran police and military. So, for example, there has been 7 people that have been convicted and found guilty. We're still waiting for the Supreme Court in Honduras to basically certify those results. They have been held accountable, sort of, for being involved in her murder. And then there was a co-author that COPIN is very careful with the way that they label the people that are being held accountable for her murder, because it's really important to draw out who were the people that actually carried out and pulled the trigger. And then who are the people that were actually like masterminding it, funding it, and that benefited from her murder. And so David Castillo was found guilty, I believe, in 2021 or 2022. He was actually trained in the United States, and he was one of the co-authors, the co-intellectual authors of her murder. And I think, you know, he was backed by the United States. He was an intelligence officer. There were other military and police that were involved in her murder. And so I think that talking about Berta Cáceres represents so much of what happened and continues to happen in Honduras under a narco state and the impacts of the narco state.
So at the very least, her death could perhaps also serve as a microcosm to the lengths both local and foreign businesses went to making Honduras extremely dangerous for activists. Because truth be told, there are thousands of Berta Cáceres type cases that took place during this time period that have gone without any degree of justice here. So we are out of time, unfortunately, but we have about 1 minute left, actually. So Karen, I'm really fascinated by this idea of holding both the Canadian government and Canadian businesses accountable in the coming weeks and months ahead. Where else can people learn about this? And what other things should we point out here before we wrap up?
Sure. Thank you. So I think that it's really important that we remember that this is ongoing work that we have to do in Canada, the United States. We can talk about the trial. Ho now faces life in prison, but there's so much more work to do to hold the U.S. and Canada accountable for what happened in Honduras and what continues to happen. People can find out more about the campaign, which continues. It's called Putting the U.S. and Canada on Trial campaign at hondurasnow.org. And on the Honduras Solidarity Network, Facebook and Twitter, we have a Senate action calling on the U.S. Senate to basically open investigations into the role of the United States. And we will continue that campaign probably the next year or so. But we really need support. We need to have mobilization in the U.S. to achieve it. And we need to keep the campaign alive, even though the trial is now over. And we know now that the U.S. supported and funded and legitimized a violent drug trafficker that will spend the rest of his life in prison. So again, that's hondurasnow.org for more information.
And again, it's a small degree of justice, but, you know, it's not something that we can't frown upon too much. Any degree of justice, especially for Honduras, is much needed for the Honduran public. So with that said, we are out of time. We've been speaking with Adrian Pine, who's an anthropologist and co-coordinator of the International Coalition to Stop Genocide in Palestine. Thank you very much for being on the show with us, Adrian Pine.
Thanks so much for having me again, Oscar.
Absolutely. And we've been speaking as well with Karen Spring, who's a researcher, host of the Honduras Now podcast, and a co-coordinator of the Honduras Solidarity Network. Thank you for being on the show with us, Karen Spring.
Thank you so much, Oscar.
You got it. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
Hello, WPFW. Festival season is here, which means good music, good food, and good people. The 8th annual Words, Beats, and Life Festival kicks the season off with events from April 1st through 7th in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Featured artists include a special evening with Saul Williams, April 5th at Woolly Mammoth Theater, Sunken Cages, Dragon Child, and Faraway Ghost at Millennium Stage, April 4th, Diggable Planets, Sun Ra Orchestra, and more at the Jazz and Blossoms Park Jam, April 7th. Plus, poetry slams, hip-hop education conference, and free dance workshops all week. To learn more about all the events, visit wblinc.org/WBLFest.
The search process for WPFW's next general manager is underway. Successful management searches begin by having conversations with stakeholders to clarify and document expectations for future management. Therefore, WPFW's local station board is inviting all stakeholders to participate in our online survey. Go to WPFWFM.org and press the link to complete the survey. The survey closes April 3rd, 2024. Only one survey per person. Thank you. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bengert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. A massive crane is expected to arrive in Baltimore today to assist in efforts to clean up debris from the Key Bridge, which collapsed earlier this week following a cargo ship collision. Federal transportation officials have authorized $60 million in emergency funds to support the cleanup effort. Experts say the cost of reconstructing the bridge could exceed $1 billion and could take years, depending on how quickly supplies are gathered and permits are acquired. The bodies of six of the construction workers who died on the bridge have been recovered. Four other workers are still unaccounted for and presumed dead. Officials said they were pausing the search for more bodies as the focus turned to clearing debris. Meanwhile, the flow of ships in and out of the Port of Baltimore has been halted indefinitely. The Biden administration pledged an aggressive effort to reopen the port, which handles up to $200 million worth of cargo on a typical day. Another emerging concern is that hazardous material may be leaking from some of the containers on the ship. Based on the cargo manifest, federal officials have determined the ship was carrying 56 containers of corrosive, flammable material and lithium-ion batteries, some of which were breached. Authorities have observed a sheen on the waterway, indicating potential leakage. The environmental impact is still unclear. House Republicans said yesterday that they will send two articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate on April 10th. Republicans blame Mayorkas for record flows of migrants across the U.S.-Mexico border. Mayorkas was narrowly impeached by the House last month on allegations that he failed to enforce U.S. immigration laws and made false statements to Congress. Mayorkas has said that he does not bear responsibility for the border situation, blaming it instead on a broken U.S. immigration system that Congress has refused to fix. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer issued a statement saying that once the House managers bring the articles of impeachment to the Senate, senators will be sworn in as jurors for a trial the next day. The federal government is updating how it records race and ethnicity data about the U.S. population, creating more categories to reflect the country's complex diversity. Under the revisions, race and ethnicity questions that had been asked separately would now be joined, allowing respondents to choose multiple categories at the same time. A Middle Eastern and North African category will be added, meaning many people who had previously checked white on a questionnaire for lack of options will now be more accurately represented. The changes also eliminate the terms majority and minority from questionnaires. The new changes did receive some pushback, including from the Arab American Institute, whose executive director said the new Middle Eastern and North African category still omits some people. Louis Gossett Jr., the first black man to win a supporting actor Oscar for his role in An Officer and a Gentleman, has died at the age of 87. His first cousin told the Associated Press that the actor died early this morning in Santa Monica. The cause of death is unknown. Throughout his career, Gossett appeared in more than 50 films and hundreds of television shows. He made his film debut in 1961 in A Raisin in the Sun, an adaptation of the Lorraine Hansberry play. He broke through on TV as Fiddler in the groundbreaking 1977 miniseries Roots, which depicted the atrocities of slavery. He would go on to be awarded an Emmy for that role. In addition to his Academy Award and the Emmy, Gossett won a Golden Globe Award for Best Supporting Actor in HBO's The Josephine Baker Story in 1992. His contributions to Hollywood were honored in 1992 with a star on the Walk of Fame.